a piece, we're going mainstream. Everybody's gonna eat, we're going mainstream. All my family is sick. See you on Main Street, we're going mainstream.
From Wall Street to Melrose Avenue,
we're going mainstream.
Venture capitalists to athletes to
we're
creators to the person who's collected trading cards.
Welcome back to the Alco's Mainstream Podcast. Today, we have an incredible discussion that spans the world of private credit and the growth of women's sports and how those two topics intersect in the guest's daily life. Chris Long founded Palmer Square Capital Management, an approximately $29 billion asset manager focused on corporate and structured credit with offices in Kansas City and London in June 2009. Currently, he serves as chairman, CEO, and portfolio manager. Since inception, Chris has been successful in building one of the premier credit investment firms in the world that includes clients across institutions, family offices, RIAs, bank and trust, and broker-dealers. Prior to starting Palmer Square, Chris built a deep investment background at some of the top financial services firms in the world, including Morgan Stanley, T.H. Lee Putnam Ventures, and J.P. Morgan. In December 2020, Chris added the title of professional sports team owner, as he joined as the co-founder and owner Angie Long and co-owner Brittany Mahomes in bringing a National Women's Soccer League franchise to Kansas City. The Kansas City Current launched on an extraordinary timeline, playing its first professional match just 124 days after the franchise was announced. As owners, Chris, Angie, Brittany, and recent addition to ownership, Patrick Mahomes, have had a clear vision for not only establishing the best women's soccer club in the world, but also having the Kansas City Current serve as a model for all of women's sports, which was no more apparent than the recent completion of their new stadium, a $124 million project that is the first soccer stadium specifically built for a women's professional soccer team. Chris serves on the National Women's Soccer League's Board of Governors and Expansion Committee, as well as on the Executive Committee of the Kansas City 2026 World Cup bid. Chris was recently recognized for winning the prestigious Kansas City Sports Commission's 2022 Sports Executive of the Year and Sports Business Journal's 2022 Power Players Women's Sports. He and his wife, Angie, were inducted into the 2023 Junior Achievement of Greater Kansas City Business Hall of Fame. Chris and I had a fascinating conversation that spanned the world of credit and sports team ownership and investing, and how those two worlds are coming together. We discussed how Chris and his team built a $29 billion asset manager in the credit space, why he believes that private credit's growth does not represent a systemic risk despite a more lax lending environment due to increased capital inflows and increased competition for good deals, why he believes the one-stop shop will emerge in credit for both borrowers and LPs, why a background in credit and investing has been invaluable in understanding how to navigate the business side of building and running a sports franchise, how Chris decided to buy an NWSL team with his wife and co-founder Angie, why Chris believes investing in women's soccer in the U.S. is like buying the Boston Celtics in the 1960s, why owning your own facilities as a sports team is a huge lever to increase revenues and drive enterprise value, how driving business initiatives for a sports team can help build the community and build the roster. Thanks, Chris, for coming on the show to share invaluable insights into building elite performers in both the world of finance and the world of women's soccer. Good luck this season with the Current. I'll be rooting for you, except when you play Angel City FC. Chris, welcome to the Alco's Mainstream Podcast.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm pleased to be here.
Awesome. Well, it's great to have you. I think you're going to provide such interesting perspectives on, one, what you've built at Palmer Square and the world of credit. But then, two, you also are the owner of the Kansas City Current, the NWSL team in a fast-growing league and ecosystem. So it's going to be fun to talk about both the world of alts and the world of sports. And as we know, both those things are merging. So it'll be a fun conversation. Where I want to start is just your background. You've done a bunch of different things, whether it's investing in credit derivatives on Wall Street, private equity, you've been in wealth management, you've done event-driven investing. How did all these collective experiences lead you to founding Palmer Square?
If you think about what Palmer Square does, it's all about relative value. So finding the best opportunity, whether that's in U.S. corporate credit or it's in European structured credit. So we have this broad mandate, this broad and big sandbox to play in. I don't think we could have built what we have had I not had all those different experiences. Because not only does what I did in the past allow us to, I think, really exploit a lot of good relative value across many different spheres, but also being in many different types of firms allows us to understand what different investors are looking for, different investor types. And you have to marry, obviously, the investor side and the investing side to have a successful firm. So it was a good thing to have had so many roles at so many different places before starting Palmer Square.
Let's say something in there you said was really important as you think about building an alternative asset manager. That's becoming such an important piece of the puzzle here. And many firms, as they're getting larger, building businesses, you launched a BDC, which recently went public. So you're building your firm in a number of different ways. I'd love for you to talk more about the building of the business of Palmer Square.
A couple things that you think about when you're actually building an asset management firm. First thing is the people. Nothing happens without an experienced, dedicated team. And so one of our big things was finding those best athletes. We didn't hire out of undergrad or out of business school, but really focused on people that had at least that kind of 10-year plus type experience in the credit space. So people's the first part. And then the second part is obviously putting together products that are going to deliver for investors. So we've spent a lot of time listening to clients and what do they need. And it's interesting, if you look at our history there, we started with a flagship opportunistic credit offering. From that, we generated a lot of conversations and we'd get feedback. And clients might say, hey, you know what? I really like that strategy, but I want it to be more investment grade. Or I like just this part of that strategy. Can I get access to that? And from those conversations over time, we'd be able to build that product offering. So it's really the people and the products that, of course, are super critical to building a business.
Why did you start with opportunistic credit?
I always thought, just back to your first question, it was the best way to generate returns in credit, because if you're flexible, and how we define opportunistic credit is the ability to go across US, Europe, corporate credit, structured credit, and find those good opportunities. So if you have that flexibility, I think you have a higher probability of outperforming, whether it's a benchmark or your peers, absolute relative performance. I think you have a better shot at being top decile when you have that kind of flexibility. And opportunistic credit allows that.
What do you think is the core DNA of a great private credit or opportunistic credit investor and firm?
Underwriting. I mean, at the end of the day, if you're a credit investor, your upside is really getting paid timely interest and principal. And depending on what you're investing in, maybe you can buy at a discount. But generally, if you avoid default, you are going to win over time. You mathematically know this will be my return if I avoid default. And so I don't think you can exist out there and be kind of a beta-driven credit manager who's just buying everything that comes across their transom. Sooner or later, that ends up being a failure.
Well, that brings up a really interesting point. When you started, the credit world, particularly private credit, was smaller in terms of the size and scale, the firms that were in it. Now private credit has exploded and we're in a point where there's a ton of capital and dry powder. What happens with things like underwriting in today's world of private credit?
Yeah, I think that it's in on the periphery, it's gotten frothy. I mean, if you look at interest coverage ratios, especially in the smaller middle market type companies, now, there's companies that are in cyclical industries with 1 to 1.5 times interest coverage. That does not leave you a lot of cushion should something go wrong. Now, there are obviously a lot of healthy companies out there. We actually think the economy is resilient. I think of the larger company tier, kind of your large cap borrower looks very healthy. So I don't want to paint a grim picture, but nonetheless, with all of this capital that's been raised, it does look like there's some problem children that can result.
How do you think about the impact of interest rates as you look forward on private credit? I think, you know, Palmer Square has had a higher for longer house view on interest rates. What do you think about how the Fed will handle interest rates going forward and how that will impact your underwriting and also the market more broadly?
Yeah, I mean, just on the Fed, if you look at the data, there's a lot of resiliency in the economy. And we think that the way in which the market was pricing in the number of Fed cuts they were was entirely wrong based on what we see in the data. So I think you're seeing the market now correct a little bit on that. We think there's still too many price cuts for what the Fed's actually going to end up doing. And so you translate that, our view of, again, higher for longer into underwriting, we've been focusing on the larger companies that have, in our views, more sophisticated treasury groups that have been all over interest rates at these levels via hedging. You look at the companies we have in our portfolio today that we've lent money to, the vast majority, if not outside of a few, have been very good at using instruments to protect themselves from rising interest rates. So back to interest coverage ratios, we look at, like, our average was 2.5 to 5 times for our companies. Our underwriting has been that larger company subset, which we think has been able to weather this interest rate environment better than their smaller peers.
How do you think about the competitive landscape for larger companies? Because as there's more dollars flowing into private credit, many of these firms are getting larger. They probably also want to work with larger companies too, because it's, like you say, it's safer, better interest coverage ratios, healthier underwrites. How do you think about that competitive landscape as you look to find the right credits to work with?
You're absolutely right. What's happening now is there's this blurring going on where credits that we love, we've participated with before or earlier, even new credits that have the template that we like to see, they're now saying, okay, well, should I go to the broadly syndicated market because broadly syndicated offers XYZ? Or should I, as a large company, with now that there is this option, should I go direct lending private credit? Also, should I use the high yield bond market? This blurring of lending is happening at a very high velocity. And I think it's changing the way large companies think about these markets.
It's a great observation and one I want to double click on. What does this mean for companies or borrowers? How should they think about the lending market and who they should take capital from and how?
I firmly believe, especially think about private equity-backed companies, you want to be with somebody that can participate in both markets. So you don't have to manage so many lending relationships, but you want to have somebody who, if it's the decision of the company or the private equity firm to go direct credit, I could go to Palmer Square. Oh, you know what? The decision's actually, I'm going to go to broadly syndicated. Oh, I could go to Palmer Square. So that's how the winners are going to result, in our view, over the coming years. Those firms like a Palmer Square that could play in both of those markets and do so in size.
I think one theme we're certainly seeing with many of these larger alternative asset managers is that they are trying to become a one-stop shop on both sides of their marketplace as an investor into companies or products. And then on the LP side too, you want to be able to serve both sides with a breadth and depth of different solutions. How have you thought about that business evolution at Palmer Square? And what was the trigger for you observing and saying, hey, you know what? We need to be the place where we can be a solutions provider, like you just said.
From our vantage point, it's listening. You know, and it's really taking the time to focus on the client, what they need. And a lot of times, it's just a different product wrapper. You're not changing your research process. You're not impacting your competitive advantage. Instead, you're having, let's have a mutual fund that these people can access. Let's have a separately managed account. Let's have a collective investment trust. Let's have a private fund. Let's have a BDC. We've really been aggressive about how people access our solutions. But the reality is our solution subset hasn't changed too much over time.
How much has listening, just active listening that you've done to figure out the right solutions for the market, been driven by the type of LP that you've wanted to work with?
100% is the answer. We have really, if you look at our LP base today, three big components would be institutional consulting, family office, and wealth management. And each of those are slightly different flavors of ways they want to access managers like Palmer Square. But by listening to those three main channels, that's how we've built our platform.
How have you gone about working with the wealth channel? That's something that many of these firms are trying to figure out how to do. And I don't think wealth is just one thing, right? Or one type of customer. You have to serve each customer. Family office is very different from the wealth management RIA private bank community. How did you go about building and constructing a sales force to work with each of those channels and figure out what the right way to sell into those channels were?
We tried to be where we weren't everything to everyone. But when you think about the wealth channel, the way we've grown up in it is we actually haven't built a sales force to go and sell to every financial advisor at every wirehouse or every independent brokerage. Instead, the wealth channel for us has been more of your Schwab and Fidelity user, your independent RIA, your consolidator in the RIA space, people like that. That's allowed us to not have to have the 50-person wholesaling group, but to have a really highly experienced, very product-centric, sort of consultant-like sales force that's a lot smaller.
You used a word that I think is critical in the sale of any alternative, consultative or consultant. It very much is a consultative sale. It's over the long term. You're not just there to sell a product. How have you thought about educating both your team internally on how to work with the wealth channel? And then related to that, educating the wealth channel on why Palmer Square and why the investment strategies and where it fits into their portfolios.
From a product platform standpoint, what we did that matches that consultative or that solutions provider mindset is we've built everything from ultra short, almost like enhanced cash type products, all the way up the risk spectrum where you sort of get, kind of increase the risk and you decrease liquidity, all the way to private credit, structured credit. So we literally have the gamut. And when you have that, you can go in with an idea that, hey, I'm not just trying to sell one suite of things. I want to know, what do you need on your end? Are you serving ultra high net worth people? Or are you serving the mass affluent? What product and what strategy is going to resonate most with you? And then react to that because we have it. It starts a lot with just having the products to be able to go in there and approach it with an open mindset. And when you think about educating clients, they know what they want. And they're very, very good at sort of saying, okay, this is what's missing in what I have, and or this group's not performing well enough, so I need someone who's going to do this. You just have to get that out of them so that you can react. I think that's the biggest piece of the puzzle for us, is just making sure to get that right information, and then we have something that'll resonate with them.
What have you done to be able to grow the business so quickly? I mean, you're almost at $30 billion of AUM. That's a pretty rapid rise. I think it's been only 15 years or so. That's incredibly impressive.
Oh, well, I appreciate that. I would say client retention is huge. We have a variety of statistics we point to, but the one I like best is sort of we're in the high 90s as far as client retention. So never lose somebody that you work so hard to bring into the fold. I'd say number two, compelling performance. We've got a really long, distinguished track record across every strategy we do. And again, whether that's absolute or on a relative basis. And then finally, it's team retention. This business is really hard. It's very competitive. And from a team perspective, we've all been doing this a while. We know each other's strengths and weaknesses. And that allows us to give clients confidence that Palmer Square is going nowhere. It's the team that I always deal with. And so I think you got to look at the retention, the performance, and then the team.
So the last point is one that I want to touch on in two contexts. One is I saw an article recently that said really senior private credit professionals, I think this was, specific to Europe, but I think it probably applied to the US, were like making at large banks or private credit funds like $15 million plus a year. Private credit's clearly in demand. That's obviously not necessarily the case across industry or platform or whatever, but I share that statistic just to highlight, one, how important firms view this as core to their business and their growth and also an investment class, but also how they think about hiring and retaining top talent. And then you have the large platforms, the Blackstones, the Apollos, the Ares, the Blue Owls, et cetera, who are all becoming bigger and bigger. How do you think about team retention in a world where businesses are investing more and more in private credit capabilities?
first, obviously, you have to compensate people with what's a fair and market-driven rate. I mean, obviously, that's a core part of everything from a retention perspective, but it's so much more than that. You've got to also provide people with an environment where they feel like they're really driving value and contributing. So you think about what we do here at Palmer Square. When people come and they work for Palmer Square, and we're based in Kansas City, they're making a broader decision. It's not just compensation, but it's everything else around that, the firm itself, the work-life balance. So we've had a lot of success in retaining highly talented people. The other part of it is we have 12 partners that have full equity in our firm. And that is a huge deal to today's professional, that they can not only come to a place where they can get that balance, that ability to really add value, but they can also benefit commensurate with what the owners are doing.
One thing I also noticed on your website was that you state clearly the firm is 100% owned by the founders and partners.
We're really proud of that. From a everyday perspective, I think everyone at our firm, all 58 people, act like owners. So it goes beyond just those 12, which I obviously proudly highlighted. Every single person, for example, part of the compensation plan with our firm is that every person has a percentage, everybody, of their compensation goes into our fund. So whether you're with us a year or you've been with us 15 and you're one of the most senior people, regardless, you are sitting yourself side by side with clients. So it's a big deal here.
Being invested yourself is so important when you're bringing others into the fold too. What do you like about private credit and why do you think it's so popular right now?
If you look, and I'll just do from backdrop, for us, we focus on those larger companies. So you're thinking like $1 billion plus term loans. So right there, I think you've got an opportunity to, then secondarily, you're seeing the regulatory environment for banks is not getting any better. And so there's just more and more paper getting pushed into this marketplace. And so from an end investor perspective, you're getting yield on, you know, paper that has a low history of default from borrowers that are very significant multinational companies. I don't know what there isn't to love on that.
So you mentioned banks having challenging regulatory environment. There was obviously issues in the U.S. banking system with Silicon Valley Bank being one of the prominent cases from last year. And banks have seemingly, the larger banks even, have seemingly retrenched a little bit, or at least the large private credit firms have kind of been encroaching on their territory a little bit. How do you see that shaking out going forward?
You know, we have conversations obviously with banks all the time. And I think they're terrified about increased regulatory scrutiny when it comes to this area of the marketplace. And as a result, they're pulling back. I look at where we are, and as a lender who could be broadly syndicated, could be doing private credit, we have a huge opportunity to fill that gap. And that gap, again, is growing. So I think it's something that's not stopping anytime soon. And if there is some sort of economic pullback that puts pain in the system, now that's going to further exacerbate regulatory environment. And so again, anyway, I think you look at it, we sit in a good spot to take advantage of opportunities.
So the detractors of private credit and its growth are concerned that maybe there's a systemic risk. Do you think that's the case?
I don't. Do I think there's going to be more defaults coming out of private credit? I do. I mentioned earlier the smaller middle market, cyclical industry that got so much leverage put on their balance sheet. That's a risk. But is it systemic that would cause widespread contagion? No, definitely not. And one of the beauties of the corporate bank loan market is what happens in technology is not what happens in food and drug, which is not what happens in consumer retail. There is a lack of correlation within the corporate industry structure that in and of itself, I think, is a powerful detractor from systemic type risk happening here. Because again, you don't usually see a lot of defaults in a lot of different industries at the same time. And I think that is something that's really important for people to think about.
So does that mean, in your view, you think private credit has plenty of room to run in terms of the size and scale that it can digest from a capital allocation perspective?
Yeah, I think you're going to continue to see that market grow. And it's a very important piece of the capital markets now. I mean, it's financing a lot of different industries. And the way a lot of the markets like this work is momentum begets momentum and continues to grow.
Momentum beginning momentum. Where I want to go with that comment is, how much do you think size and scale matters in private credit? Is this the type of thing where the firms that have really large size and scale are going to benefit from that? And you also mentioned the syndicated loan market. Now it feels like firms are kind of going at it themselves and just doing direct lending without a broadly syndicated group. So what's your view on size and scale, and how does that unfold too?
The most important characteristic for a lender going forward is that ability to participate in both the syndicated market and in the direct market. Because we're seeing right now credits that are broadly syndicated credits going to private credit. Now we're seeing private credit go to broadly syndicated. It's really becoming almost like a menu for a private equity backed company or even a strategic to look at and decide which is best for them. So within that construct, of course, size and scale is helpful. I think you need to be able to write a material check in either market. And I think you need to be able to do it quickly. So relationships matter, and ability to do the underwriting that's required is paramount.
I think you're bringing up a really interesting point, which is it's not just the investment product itself that's important for many investors in the wealth channel, but it's how you can access that product and the handling of the post-investment aspect of it, the operational piece. You can buy it in a ticker traded product that you can fit into a portfolio in a certain way. So many of those things, I think that that's an important piece of this too. Where I want to head next is, what do you view as the things that worry you most about the credit markets going forward?
Believe it or not, as a credit investor, I should be glass half empty, I recognize, but I'm fairly optimistic. I would say the things that worry me most are sort of the geopolitical realm, just seeing something that's a factor like that, that's unknown, that really causes not just a regional issue, but a more global conflict. There's so much fragility out there today and in the world, at least politically. That's something I think about all the time. That's like a game-changing type event.
Yeah. From that perspective, how do you position your firm and your portfolios against that?
We do a ton of stress testing. We're still running COVID scenarios on every single corporate credit that we take exposure to. Some people might think that's extreme, but I think it's just judicious to really think that there's still a probability of events like that. So it's the stress testing. I'd say secondarily, we always have a higher quality bent. If we're doing something in the investment grade world, we'd prefer a single A over a triple B. Or if we're in the high yield world, we'd prefer a double B over a single B. And then finally, industries. Industries are really critical. So how does an industry react to some sort of conflict of scale? We've been overweight non-cyclical industries because we believe they'll be less susceptible to something that would be a massive economic move down.
So from that perspective, obviously can't predict when another COVID-like event happens or even a geopolitical event happens. But post that happening, do you think that you will stay overweight certain sectors or categories just because of the kind of margin for safety cushion you want to have?
It's all relative value. That is such a great question. The answer is obviously, I don't know, because it's all based on what do prices look like at that point? And also what do recoveries look like? If you have something that we think is trading below recovery value, and it's in an industry that's more cyclical, we'll probably get involved because that's something that is, from our vantage point, a good risk return opportunity. But it could be the reverse too. It's something that's cheap should be cheap, and we'll obviously stay away from it.
It's how do you balance the macro with the micro? From a relative value perspective, you're looking very much at the industry itself or the specific firm within the industry. I think you made a really astute point, which is we live in a world that is more geopolitically challenging. Cycles seem to happen faster. You obviously have a lot more unknowns when it comes to politics, when it comes to potential risks like COVID, et cetera. So how do you balance the interplay between macro and micro?
We start top down. So we start with credit macro and GDP, consumer confidence, inflation here, Europe, China. I mean, we're distilling all of that into what we literally think of as summary takeaways. Sean, these types of macro statistics, what are we comfortable taking as far as risk? And then we overlay that with, okay, so what are CLOs looking like versus high yield? What's high yield look like versus investment grade? When you put those two together, it directs your micro. It says, okay, well, based on the following, we have confidence in low default rates. We believe in CLOs being inexpensive relative to loans. Let's go spend more time there. It's really a process that you have to blend the two together. I don't know how in this environment you cannot incorporate macro-related statistics, because they're so important to make sure to get right.
Was that something that became more protracted or moved to the forefront post-COVID? Or was that something that you always thought about?
Always part of our investment process. Yeah, that's a core DNA type item that's been part of it for a while.
What do you think was the biggest takeaway from the COVID period as a credit investor?
Companies are innovative. I honestly think how corporate America reacted was tremendous. Obviously, you had the Fed and you obviously had a lot of liquidity in the system, and there's all sorts of things that are important from a backdrop component. But look, companies cut costs. Companies found innovative ways to grow top line. And then lastly, with that liquidity that, again, a lot of the Fed helped, companies refinanced and did interesting things with their liquidity. So that's a 1-2-3 punch that we are pleased to see and gives me a lot of hope should an environment like that evolve again, that there is a blueprint for companies and how to react.
What I love about that answer, and then a word you used before, is optimism. And I think if we transition to the other part of your life, there's a lot of reasons to be optimistic. And I think it's fascinating for a credit investor. You've not only found relative value in what you've done in women's soccer, in the NWSL and Kansas City Current, but you've also found absolute value. So I'd love to get inside the mind of how did you and why did you think about buying the Kansas City Current NWSL team? You've done a ton of innovative things, both that you can physically see, the stadium and practice facility that you've built, but also things you can't see as much. So we'd love to just understand what your thought process was behind all of that.
Yeah, I appreciate that question and comment. From a decision-making perspective, it's really twofold. First is seeing it through our daughter's eyes, the fact that women's soccer is so powerful and these incredible female role models and the beauty of the sport. It's honestly just something that we believe in on so many different levels. But then you combine the second part of that decision is return on investment. We studied the financial model. Most people out there were trying to break even or just lose a little bit of money and not a lot of investment. And from our day jobs at Palmer Square, that seemed so silly. So it was very easy for us to look at the modeling and say, okay, here is what we need to do. And when we looked at that, we said, wow, this isn't just a 20% growth. This is many multiples. This is 5X, 10X, et cetera. So in a lot of ways, it felt like being part of the buying group of the Boston Celtics in the 1960s. That's how it felt to us.
What was the point in your mind where things just clicked, where it's like, wow, this is going to be a growth market?
So in 2019, we went to the Women's World Cup in Paris, France. And I actually spent almost a month there, because my then 13-year-old daughter was asked to play in a lot of international friendlies around France. So we got to see it from so many different angles. That was a turning point for Angie, my wife, and myself, was seeing that. It was global. You're starting to see countries investing, not necessarily in leagues, but the sovereigns, whether that was in Europe, it was Australia, New Zealand. And we knew that that was going to be the trickle-down effect that would then hit the leagues. It just was so apparent. That was a powerful trip for us, and one we'll definitely never forget.
So you then ended up buying the Current in 2020. What was the process of, okay, 2019, your eyes were open to how interesting this opportunity could be from a business building perspective and also helping to grow the game? I think on the personal side too, having, and I should say, incredibly successful, both sounds like academically and athletically, daughters who are going to play D1 sports, including soccer, I'm sure probably helped in that regard, but also incredibly impressive. What was the process of saying, okay, we now need to get involved in this, not just as a more passive lean back fan, but as a lean forward, let's help build this space?
initially our whole thought was, how do we get to know people? Because we have this wonderful network in finance across investment management, but we don't have that similar network in sports. So how do we do that? And so little by little, we got in contact with the commissioner of the NWSL. We got to talk to most every owner of a team at that point. We talked to a lot of owners on the men's side. We just needed to kind of figure out what were the ingredients for success. And all the while we were doing that, we're also selling ourselves, no longer as successful investors, but the fact that we could be successful sports owners. What's funny about it is we were told initially, hey, well, maybe you can get an expansion right in 2023 or 2024. There was no guarantee. And we were certainly willing to wait, but we just said, hey, you know what? We're here. We would love to move sooner. We know Kansas City is a great market. And then we had the opportunity to effectively buy the Utah franchise, which we did on December 6, 2020. And so the rest is obviously now we're on our fourth season.
I first want to get to, before moving into the current and what you've built there, is I think it's fascinating that there's different ways to build and run a sports team. You and your wife, Angie, who both run Palmer Square, you have a credit DNA. How do you think having a credit DNA has helped you run a sports team? Because there's so many pieces to the sports side of it. It's not necessarily like traditional investing in a number of ways. And yet you've seen other incredibly successful credit investors. I'll name one, Mark Lazary from Milwaukee Bucks and his syndicate. He was a credit guy with Avenue Capital. How do you think that background has helped you as you've invested in and then built the current?
Yeah, Mark, very, very impressive story for sure. When we did the financial modeling, one of the biggest levers was facilities and owning your own facilities. But what was interesting about it, though, is never had there been female anchor tenant facilities, whether on the training side and certainly not on the stadium side. So, okay, then you put our credit hat on and we go to banks because we need financing. And we had to prove to them that this was a viable endeavor. Well, if we had not been the people we are at Palmer Square, we would never have been able to translate what we were doing in sports to what a lender requires. Typically, lending in sports, one of the biggest things is enterprise value of the team. And that's security to the bank. Well, there was no data on women's teams that was anywhere near the amount of money we were requesting. So then it also came into structuring the financing. And again, like, we know how to do that. So we really had a big edge in being able to now create this, what is arguably one of the top and most revenue generating entities across women's sports. The Kansas City Current is at the top of the list as we speak in just not even 3+ years.
What were those conversations with banks like? And how did you go about proving to them that you would be a good credit?
We went and had to sell the sponsorship angle that we would be able to get the naming rights partner. We would be able to get the gates. We would be able to get the training center complex partner. That was a big piece because those are obviously large revenue items. They're very important to the visibility of it all. We had to sell that we can do that. Again, people that financed us, and we've got multiple banks that we've worked with, they knew we did that at Palmer Square. We had big clients. We had a history of success. So really trying to tie the two together to say, look, we did this here. We can do the same thing there. It was a lot of trying to extrapolate our track record from Palmer Square onto the Kansas City Current, despite it only being a very tight 1 year, 12-month-old type situation. And we were successful at it. People believe that we can do what we did before now with sports.
How much did banks also see the opportunity to partner with a fast-growing league and team? And you also look at the data around women athletes and their ability to connect with their fans. And then for the banks or other sponsors you have, reach a whole new set of potentially engaged consumers in a way that maybe others can't.
It's absolutely associating with the sport and the league as well. They're obviously doing it through the Kansas City Current, but it's all one nicely built package with a bow on it. The fact that the NWSL has had such an upward trajectory, the fact that if you look at the participation in women's soccer from the youth level up, it's exploded. It's all one big pie that I think that they definitely wanted to be associated with.
I think that's fascinating to hear and really a jumping off point to the question around institutionalization of sports. So you mentioned all these things that you did to work with financing partners, which is so key, was really due to your background as a financier and your credit background. You did it in a personal capacity, obviously not through Palmer Square. We're now seeing plenty of funds, the Ares of the world, the Redbirds of the world, you name it. They have Arctos. They have sports-related funds and sports-specific investment strategies, whether equity or credit. How do you think what you said about your background and ability to navigate this world because of your finance background will translate to the institutionalization of sports with institutional investors coming into the game?
We relate so well to the whole private equity world. Palmer Square is a firm that's done over, I don't even know, 1,300 backed private equity company loans. It's really a natural extension for us. And it makes sense that these firms are not only raising funds specifically dedicated to this and or investing in these in a one-off situation. Because if you think about sports, it's the only place, it's live content. You can't replicate it. It is happening. It's emotional. It is absolutely something that people want to be part of. And there's a winner and there's a loser. So I think from a value perspective, as things get so technologically driven in the society, sports is still one of those unknown kind of things that drive visual interest, spectator interest. So I think you're going to continue to see private equity firms move more and more into it.
I want to move to the soft side or the other side of the coin in that regards. Obviously, investing in sports, teams or leagues are investable opportunities. As a result, we're seeing more funds invest for the benefit of their LPs and to generate returns. How does that then impact the other side of sport, which is the on-field product? And how do you harmonize both the business side of building a sports franchise, which is about its live content, but also the on-the-field product of teams, players, coaches performing on the field, and also understanding that balancing those are not the easiest things in the world.
One of the things that is notable about expansions, what you're talking about, is more capital comes in and expands. With expansion, you got to make sure that the player pool is there, the coaching pool is there, and you're not diluting the overall, again, back to live content, you're not diluting the experience of the corporate sponsor, of the fan, of the people watching that sport by having quality go down. So that's interesting when you think about as more money comes in, you have to make sure the youth development's there and you're continuing to expand that top high quality player pool. You're doing it globally. So there's always a balancing act there. And then again, that extends to coaches too and making sure there's enough top-notch quality coaches who can move into these expansion opportunities and the quality stays just as good as it is right now.
I think you're bringing up a really interesting point, which is the understanding of both sides about what you're trying to accomplish. You almost have to build two different businesses within one brand and complex, right? The business side and the on the field side. Those two things may not always be balanced at the same time. You can't control on the field success all the time. You can't control external factors there. And then that may impact the business side. How do you make sure that the players understand the business side while also giving them the freedom and peace of mind they can just go and play on the field and do their job?
At the end of the day, the sport exists because of the players, and the interest exists because of the players. It all goes to the players. So one, you have to illustrate that every decision you make, you show the players it's about them because it has to be. And from a business perspective, what we do at the Kansas City Current is we're always giving the informational transparency on the business side to the players because they deserve that. And the club exists because of them. You're a steward of something, and the two people that you have to be transparent to are the players and the community.
I love that answer for so many reasons because that is really what it is at the end of the day. You talk about being player-centric. You did something that is so incredibly player-centric. It seems like it's reflecting itself in retaining top talent. I believe Dabinia came out and said that she stayed in part because of the stadium you built. You also have re-signed a number of other players, attracted free agents as a result of the stadium you built. So it's awesome to see you investing in both your team and the community and the game more broadly from this. But I have to go to you built the first soccer stadium purpose-built for women's soccer. So talk to us about that.
It's funny. I recognize the gravity of it, but at its basic tenet, I think it's just such a no-brainer because it's exactly what you just said. And then you said it so articulately. Everything ties together. It's an investment for the community that has a multiplier effect in so many ways, not only financially, but also for being able to have these incredibly powerful women role models in your backyard. What does that do to your community, young boys, young girls, adults, every walk of life? The second part is you think about elite women athletes should have elite stadiums. But it's not just the province of a men's sport to have a great facility that you can see your brand. You can see it's your locker room. It's not somebody's second or third locker room. It's your corporate sponsors who are out there that are there for you. So it's just, it all comes together for us in such an easy to understand way that we're honestly kind of shocked that someone hadn't done it before.
How did you go about building the stadium in a way that would be unique to the needs of your team and the women's game?
When you look at the stadium, the biggest thing, I think it's unique to our team. I don't know that it's necessarily unique to the women's game. Some might say it is, but what we tried to create is this intimate environment where the furthest seat from the touchline being obviously where the game starts, is 94 feet. It is very intimate. The players, if you watch the women's game, they want to be involved in the community. After games, they're signing autographs, win or lose, for an hour and a half at times. So we try to create something that had them close to the fans, had it from the way the benches are structured to how they walk out. We wanted it to be like that. Even the roof line, again, back to creating an intimate environment, we structured a roof line that's really innovative with a curvature that keeps the sound in. So just trying to make it to be the best playing experience that a team could possibly experience.
I think you're bringing up something so important, which is, and this relates to it being for the community. We've seen this in Angel City too, where the seats are very close in some respects. And it's like, you really feel like you are part of the game. And think of what that does for the next generation of soccer talent, where they can actually then see their idols on the field, they can picture them, and then they can actually feel like, okay, I'm a part of this. So I think that's such an important point that you make about how do you build this so that people actually understand what they're part of. So I thought that was a fascinating way of thinking about it. The other piece of this is, this was not an inexpensive endeavor. How did you end up financing and convincing investors to invest into $117 million, I think it was, stadium?
Yeah, I think it's more like 125, but
yeah. Construction costs, they go up, right? As time goes on.
Quality is never inexpensive. I would tell you from a financing perspective, two debt financiers, our team did all of the equity. And so it was convincing those debt investors to believe in the revenue model and what we were achieving. And as I mentioned earlier, I feel like we really had an advantage because there wasn't the data out there to really give precedent. There wasn't a precedent. You know, we could show the financial model. We could show exactly what we thought we could do with each revenue line item, but there wasn't a precedent on the women's side that a bank or bank could go to and say, oh, I see this has already happened. So then it became bridging it again back to what we did at Palmer Square and the fact that, hey, look, we did this here. We know how to build things. We're going to do it on this end too. And that was successful. But I will tell you, we didn't have 50 banks competing to do this. We talked to a lot of people and it really came down to two that were like, okay, let's talk further and actually put term sheets together. I think now going forward, one of the maybe cool things we've done for the market is now there are going to be a lot of banks competing to finance the next stadium that's purpose-built for a women's team.
That brings me to a statistic that jumped out in the recent article that Stephen Goff from the Washington Post came and visited your stadium that was fully built. I saw it when it wasn't, and it was incredible to see the final masterpiece as you get ready for the season. But he said that the financial health for the current will improve by at least $20 million over last season. And in large part, it sounds like due to the stadium. I'd love to hear more about that because that showcases, one, you're building for the community and your team. But two, there's a real financial opportunity here too.
Steve's amazing. And I very much appreciated that question. In fact, we have that revenue already, but it was really raised on the premise of the 2024 season and having that stadium. So without that stadium, we don't have that. And not only do we not have that, we're a renter. We're paying rent, which is significant, on a game-by-game basis. We're sharing F&B on a game-by-game basis. The economic difference is really staggering. Steve has such a big voice, such a big platform. I hope people see that, because I think it's going to encourage people to relook at their business model around women's sports and think, how can I get these facilities in place? Because it's a meaningful change.
I think the other thing too is that no team likes playing on the road, but teams who are playing on the road may actually be excited to play at the stadium because of everything that you built.
Well, yeah, I'll tell you a funny story. I appreciate. So when we were designing the stadium, one of the obviously key aspects of it is, what do the locker rooms look like? We went to talk to our team about it. We talked to different owners. And a lot of times what you have is a home locker room that's fabulous. And then you have a visitor locker room that's average. It maybe has some weird colors. We went the other way. We're like, you know what? Let's give the visitor locker room. Let's give them an amazing experience. So when they get there, they're going to be like, wow, this is really cool. So it's going to be fun when we have teams come through to get their response, because we're trying to really create a great environment, even from the point of which they're putting their boots on before they even get on the pitch, let alone once they're on the pitch, it's going to be rocking. I mean, it's going to be rocking.
So you're just going to make teams so relaxed that they just come in a little more, wow, this feels too much like home. This is great. I see what you're trying to do there. I will say, I'll root for you all, with the exception of two games against Angel City. But other than that, I hope you have a ton of success. And I think you're very well set up for that. On that point, what does success look like for you over the next few years in women's soccer?
Perennially competing and winning championships, profitable model for women's sports globally.
On that point, the theme around the globalization of the game, you've seen this happen on the men's side, and you've seen some of your peer owners also actually have a multi-club strategy of acquiring or partnering. And obviously, OL had the OL Reign. That's now changed. But there was the Olympic Lyon. They own the club in Seattle, OL Reign, for a period of time. How do you think that's going to unfold as well as owners think about this and teams think about this in a more global way to attract global fans, but also global learnings from different teams and leagues and have this kind of multi-club strategy?
The multi-club strategy is going to continue to increase. We're talking to a lot of people now that have interest in it. We have interest in it. We form kind of what we call long sports and entertainment. There aren't a lot of things anymore that are these sort of live content type businesses that I think have a lot of value. You think about women's sports in particular, there's still so many countries, so many leagues where there's no investment. There is so much upside there. We're not the only ones seeing it. Like I said, we've talked to others that want to do something similar. So stay tuned. You will see the Kansas City Current broaden our umbrella in the not too distant future.
I love that. I'm excited to see what you all do in that regard. On that point, certainly I think a lot of people have become believers that the women's game is growing, not just in soccer, but in basketball and other sports. What would you say to those right now, to the people who don't yet still fully believe, if there are any out there?
I'd love to share our financial statements and show, here's what investing in women's sports does. You look at the doubt around it now, it's slowly diminishing. But you got to talk about, for example, the great media deal the NWSL just struck, the media deal that the WNBA has, the fact that you're seeing college volleyball played in football stadiums and they sell out. I really believe there's just so many illustrations of what is transpiring in women's sports that doubt's slowly going away.
What's the next landmark moment that creates another step function change in women's soccer?
You've got the Olympics this year. And then, of course, you've got another World Cup coming. Even, honestly, the men's World Cup in 26 here in the States, that's going to have ramifications on a very, very positive basis for the women's game. There are a multitude of upcoming global events with massive media presence that are step changes in and of themselves.
That'll be exciting. We're not terribly far away from a few key events in the soccer world for the U.S., so it'll be fascinating to see where that goes. We could probably talk for a lot longer, particularly on the topic of women's soccer, but I want you to be able to get back to your day job too. The last question I always ask is, what is your favorite or most interesting alternative investment?
CLOs. I believe in the income. You know, I certainly believe in the fundamental underpinning and low level of default piece of it. And if you look over time, it's a growing market, but now it's the largest structured credit market in the world. So it's got the size, it's got the profile from a risk return perspective. So we continue to be heavy, heavy investors in that area.
That's fantastic. And I think A speaks to your expertise in that world, something you've done for years and years and done very well at it. Also done very well as more of a venture investor in the soccer world. So I love this podcast where you could be a credit person and also an optimist too. So I think it was a fantastic window into both sides of and the range of your ability to do business. So Chris, thanks so much for coming on the Alco's Mainstream podcast. Pleasure to have you. Be rooting for you on the field with the exception of two games. And good luck this season.
Thank you. It's a great opportunity for me to talk to you, and I appreciate what was such a great, fun discussion.
Pleasure to have you. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Alt Goes Mainstream. I hope you enjoyed it. You can read more about alts at my Substack, altgoesmainstream.substack.com. Thanks a lot, and have a great day. We're going mainstream.